Well, every year on this Shabbat, right before Yom Kippur, I do the same teaching. So I really didn't even have to study for today. And the reason I do this same teaching is because it's for the same reason we do a Passover Seder every year in the spring. Every Passover Seder, what do? We eat the same kind of foods. We eat the matzah. We talk about the Passover story and how through Moses, God brought the people out of Egypt by the blood of the lamb, by the body of the lamb. They were delivered from death to life, from slavery to freedom. And then we look at the Passover Seder Yeshua had here, when he said, do this, this Passover Seder, remembrance of me. And we look at how Yeshua was the fulfillment of those shadows. And every year we do this. It's a great feast. It's a wonderful time. But the other half of the story, on the flip side of the coin, the hidden side, the spiritual side, is Yom Kippur. Because the story of Passover and the story of Yom Kippur really tell the same story. But at Passover, which is a feast, and Yom Kippur, which is a fast, tell the story of our physical experience because of what Messiah accomplished. But Yom Kippur tells about the spiritual workings, about his experience, what he did as our high priest, so we could enjoy Passover. This principle is the principle of the menorah. I'm always harping on this, but all truth is given in the pattern of menorah. And so for every truth that comes out in the physical realm, there's a countering truth, a balancing truth in the spiritual. This is why the menorah stands up. If you only have a one-sided menorah, it does not stand up well. You've got to strain and struggle to keep your theology upright. But what we find is that for everything God teaches, there's a balancing truth that comes along. And not a counter-truth, but a balancing truth that just fills it out. All light in the tabernacle was produced by this menorah. This is his pattern for truth. And if you don't see the other side of whatever it is you think you know, you don't know it. We have to see things with two eyes, a left and a right. Our menorah must dwell with a left and a right that are in balance. And truth that is out of balance is called heresy. We want truth to be in balance. Even Yeshua's coming. He came once, that's one side. He's coming again, that's the other side. We must keep both of these. We're in the middle, and we must keep both of these in view. If we don't, we'll think Yeshua is just the Lamb of God, that he's just coming in mercy, that he's just coming in forgiveness and gentleness. And we'll forget the fact he's also the Lion of the tribe of Judah who comes to kick tukus, all right? And he's going to bring judgment, and there's going to be war, there's going to be a sword, and he's going to bring peace through victory. That's still coming. Lamb, lion, we have to keep these balancing truths. They're not contradictory. They are both who he is. All right, you follow? I'm going to start to preach if I'm not careful. So let's take Passover and Yom Kippur. Passover is in the spring, the first month of the religious calendar, and Yom Kippur takes place in this month, Tishrei, which is the seventh month of the religious calendar, but the first month of the civil calendar. 6 months apart, exact opposites of one another. Passover was observed in Egypt, the first one in Egypt, and home is a place of great sinfulness, great decadence, and paganism. But Yom Kippur is only observed in the temple. When the tabernacles on earth was observed there, but in the temple, it was observed only in the temple, only in Jerusalem. It cannot be acted out, it cannot be lived out anywhere else but in this place of the greatest holiness on earth. Everyone was involved in Passover. All the heads of households were involved. They all went out and killed the lamb in the evening, but at Yom Kippur, only one man's involved, the high priest. There are a few assistants just to hold things for him, but he does all the work all by himself. Everything depends on him and only on him. Here the people were told to put on their traveling clothes because they had to eat it in haste because they were taken off in the morning. But the high priest does everything in his robes of glory and purity. Passover is simple instructions. But as you're going to see, the instructions for Yom Kippur are incredibly complex. Here we see a lamb slain. But at Yom Kippur, we see a lamb, a bull, two goats, and then another lamb in the evening. At Passover, the blood was put on the doors of the homes. And the blood of that lamb passed them from death to life, from slavery to freedom, and there's great rejoicing and singing. But sin is never mentioned in the Passover liturgy, in the Passover story in Exodus. It's not mentioned. But everything about Yom Kippur is about forgiveness. And here the blood is taken, put on the outside of the doors of the homes, but taken inside into the Holy of Holies itself. And that's where it is applied. It's internal, spiritual. And it's all about payment for sin, because the wages of sin is death. So here we see how that payment is made. Passover, we just celebrate the life we get from it. At Yom Kippur, we talk about the removal of sin. But at Passover, all we talk about is our removal from slavery. Everything about Passover is our experience of rejoicing and joy and feasting because of the sacrifice that was made by the sacrifices and by the high priest on Yom Kippur. Passover is preceded by 10 plagues. Yom Kippur is preceded by 10 days of repentance, the 10 days of awe and of soul searching. Passover is about God's deliverance. Yom Kippur is about God's forgiveness. And the people travel through the wilderness immediately after the Passover Seder. They left and went into the wilderness. But here at Yom Kippur, the goat to Azazel, sometimes called the scapegoat, it is sent into the wilderness here. Sent to die. So everything about Passover is about Yeshua crucified and what we experience because of that. But and he was crucified on Passover, but Isaac was bound to the altar and was about to be sacrificed by his father Abraham on Yom Kippur, on the 10th of Tishrei back so many years ago. So to sum it all up, Passover is our experience, but it's our experience because of Messiah's accomplishments. This is why it's so important that as we celebrate Passover in the spring, we take time at this part of the year to recognize what our rejoicing cost him, what our freedom cost him, what our life cost him, and that's what Yom Kippur is all about. Again, Passover is feasting. Yom Kippur is a fast. And one other thing. Passover is one of the pilgrimage feasts. There are three times a year the men of Israel were to leave their homes and travel to Jerusalem. And that's at Passover in the spring, Shavuot, which is Pentecost in the summer, and then the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, in the fall. Yom Kippur is not a pilgrimage feast. Everybody just stayed home. Now, some people would go to Jerusalem because it's just a special time. But there's no commandment to. Because the high priest is going to be there doing what he was commanded to do behind the scenes, whether anyone is there or not. Whether anyone's there to appreciate what he's doing or not. He's there alone doing the complex and difficult things he is called upon to do. And our high priest is Yeshua. And so what we see portrayed here in Yom Kippur is a shadow of what he actually did in the heavenly tabernacle, what he actually accomplished. These are the photographs. He is the reality. Now, when you read the book of Hebrews, chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, you cannot understand them. You simply cannot understand them without understanding what we're about to go over here for Yom Kippur. Because those chapters are a commentary on Yom Kippur and on what the priest would do. Now, to give us a map, to help us understand what's taking place here, I want us to look at the temple somewhat the way it appeared when Yeshua was on earth. There you can see the temple on the Temple Mount. Here's the Temple Mount. It's the largest man-made platform in the world. And it's still there. You go to Jerusalem, you can go up there on the Temple Mount. There's no temple there now, but this is the temple proper right here. This is the east in this direction. This is the Mount of Olives up here. And the eastern gate would have been right over here. And what a magnificent structure this was. People could come in from any direction. If they came in from the south, they would go up through here. And there are many mikvot, baptismal immersion tanks, because they had to immerse before they went up. So there are mikvot. There are archaeologists are digging these and excavating these now, and they're everywhere. So when you read in Acts how thousands of people were baptized, where did they go to get baptized? Oh, they went to the temple. They went right here. Plenty of immersion tanks. They also had them over here and over on the other end. Here's a look at the temple from the, if you're on the Mount of Olives looking down, there's the eastern gate right here at the bottom. This is the temple. Now remember, when you read the description of the tabernacle, you've got the tabernacle which has the Holy of Holies and the holy place, but the temple's built on the same principle. And the holy place, the Holy of Holies, were in this building. Then the outer court is this area here. Now this extra courtyard that goes around the outside is additional, and there are other additional things added in, but it's still the same schematic. Right here is the court of the women, and but men went in there, of course, as well. And if you were to go down to the court of the women, which is this plus sign shaped area, I'll use some color here. This area, this is the court of the women with chambers in the corners. And here we come in from the east. And these are the steps going up into the courtyard proper. Now, only the priests were allowed up in this area, or individuals who were bringing a sacrifice, the priest is going to allow them to do the slaughter. Then they could come in as well. This is the altar here. There are the steps going up into the holy place right here. And then this cube-shaped area right back here is the Holy of Holies. And only on Yom Kippur did anyone ever get to go to the Holy of Holies. And only the high priest, only on Yom Kippur, could go in there. Otherwise, it was off limits. There we are, standing at the Nicanor Gate, looking up. These are the steps. The priest would stand on these steps. They would stand on the bottom steps, sing the first song of ascent that you find in Psalms, go up a step, sing the next song of ascent, go up a step, sing the next song of ascent, all 14 steps up to the top. And this is the huge doorway going in to the holy place. It was a magnificent structure, considered to be the most beautiful building in the world and its time. Now, everything we're going to be looking at today comes from Leviticus chapter 16. And so I will have the verses on the right and illustrations on the left. So here we go. Are there any questions so far? Any questions so far? Okay. All right, here we go. Adonai spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they drew near before Adonai and died. And Adonai said to Moses, "Tell Aaron your brother not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil," that's the Holy of Holies, "before the ark cover that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the ark cover, but in this way Aaron shall come into the holy place, with a bull from the herd for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering." And here you see some young men. This is the altar. The altar was enormous. There was a ramp that came up from the south side so you could go up to the top to offer the sacrifices. And here you get an idea of just how enormous this gate was. I'm going to change colors. I'm not going to change colors. I'm going to change colors of the marker up here. That's what I'm going to do. All right. And so you can get an idea how huge this gate was. "He must put on a holy linen tunic, then leggings are to cover his body, and he is to wrap himself with a linen sash and wrap his head with a linen turban." So there are four linen garments. Those are what are pictured here on the left. So there's the leggings, his underwear. This is the tunic. Then there's the sash, and then there's the turban. Now, this is what he would wear when he would go into the Holy of Holies. The four white linen garments. When he would come out, he would change. He would add on four other garments. These are called the Bigdei Zahav, the golden garments. These golden garments consist, first of all, the golden headplate, which had engraved upon it, Holy unto the Lord, Kadosh L'Adonai. He would wear the choshen, or the breastplate, which had gold in it. There would also be this robe, this part here. This is it's called the me'il, and it had golden thread woven into it. And over that, the ephod. The ephod is this checkered-looking garment, which is like an apron, but over the back there were straps that came over just over the shoulders, and they would stop there, and then the breastplate would be fastened on to those shoulder straps. And each of these garments were either made from gold or had golden thread incorporated into their structure. They were beautiful. And, of course, down along the bottom of the me'il, there was a bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate, all the way around the hem, as is described in Exodus. The bells and the pomegranates represent the gifts of the Spirit and the fruits of the Spirit. They were in balance all the way around. Now, there's a little note here I added, that the high priest changed his garments five times during the day. He started out with all eight garments, the garments of gold. When he went into the Holy of Holies for the first time, he would take those four outer garments off and go in just in the white linen garments. He'd come back out and put on the gold garments, back and forth. And he'd be changing clothing throughout the day. Now, if you go to the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, you can see the actual breastplate that has been made and will be worn by the high priest when Yeshua returns and the kingdom is established. And there's a photograph of it. It has the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on the 12 different stones. And you can see the gold. This is real gold that is used. I see a hand up. Yes, Adam.
Is this really heavy? It seems like this would be heavy clothing to me if it's got a bunch of gold in it.
Golden thread woven into it. The only solid pieces of gold would be the gold settings for this, the breastplate, and the gold headplate. And the little chains that would clip on, those were gold. Everything else had gold thread. Yeah, they were made out of gold, they would really be heavy, but there was gold thread woven in. So they'd be kind of a bluish color with this gold woven in. It'd be beautiful. But yeah, heavy, probably a little bit, but not so heavy as an impediment to what we needed to do. And there's the actual golden, solid golden headplate that the high priest will wear. And you can see God's name there, Yud He Vav He, that's Adonai, and then Kadosh and the Lamed too, holy unto Adonai. And that's made, it's ready, it's waiting for the high priest. Now up here, can you see where our vantage point is? There is the gate, the opening of the holy place and the steps going up. Here is the altar, but notice we're looking down at the altar and the ramp. Right now, we're up on the wall, this high wall, and you can see the spiral steps here that go up. And there was a mikveh up there, and you can see some of the attendants holding up cloth so the high priest could go in and immerse himself. And here's another attendant bringing some clothing so he could immerse himself and come back out. He would immerse himself many times in the day. In fact, he would immerse himself 10 times total. And the Torah says, so he must bathe his body in water and put them on. He must also take two male goats from the congregation of the Israelites for a sin offering, one ram for a burnt offering. So here we see, first of all, the bull that we read about earlier. Then Aaron is to present the sin offering bull, which is for himself. It's for him and his family. And is to make atonement on behalf of himself and his household. And so he leans his hands. It doesn't say he lays his hands. It says he pushes down. He supports himself on the head of this bull as he confesses his own sins. Now, in the commentary in Hebrews, it talks about how the high priest would have to confess his own sins. We have a high priest who's sinless. He didn't have to confess his own sins on a bull offering. But the high priest on earth, Aaron and his descendants, ought to confess their own sins. They were not perfect. They were sinful people like everyone else. And this is the prayer we would pray. We have it word for word. He would say, I beg of you, Adonai. He'd actually pronounce God's four-letter name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He would know how it's pronounced. He would actually pronounce it. This is the only day of the year anyone would pronounce God's name. And the high priest alone was allowed to do that. I beg of you, Adonai, I have acted wickedly, rebelled, and sinned before you, I and my household. I beg of you, Adonai, forgive now the wicked acts, rebellions, and sins, for I have acted wickedly, rebelled, and sinned before you, I and my household, as is written in the Torah of your servant Moses. And here he quotes Leviticus 16:30, for on this day he will atone for you. And then when he finished this prayer, all those who would be, and you can see a crowd here has gathered to watch this. They're like a few steps down, lower level, but they can look up over and watch what's going on. They would all say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malkuto Le'olam Voed, blessed is the name, the glory of his kingship forever and ever. And there is this first confession, which I just read. Now he takes the two goats. Now, these two goats must be identical in every way. And he would go to the east, to the Nicanor gate, right at the edge of the outer courtyard, and he would face east. The temple is behind him. He's facing the east. And he takes a box, and in the box are two lots. You can see the two lots in his hands. And he would just reach in and grab them without looking, one on the left, one on the right hand. And this is what it says in Leviticus. He must then take the two goats and stand them before Adonai at the entrance of the meeting tent. And Aaron is to cast lots over the goats, one lot for Adonai and one lot for Azazel. We do not know what the name Azazel means. There are a lot of ideas. A lot of people propose meanings for this name, but we simply do not know what it means. Aaron must then present the goat which has been designated for Adonai, and he is to make it a sin offering. And the goat which has been designated by lot for Azazel is to be stood alive before Adonai to make atonement on it by sending it away to Azazel into the wilderness. Now, see how he's got one hand raised and one hand's lowered? It was always considered fortuitous, a good omen, if the lot for the Lord was in the right hand. Remember, the right hand is what? The spiritual, the left hand is the physical. And so if he could reach in and pull out the lots and look, and the lot for the Lord was in the right hand and the lot for Azazel's the left, it was like a good sign. God's blessing is on us. And so he's raising this lot. So this goat on over here on this side would be the one that is sacrificed, whose blood will be taken then into the Holy of Holies. But this goat over on the other side is for Azazel. Now here's what's interesting. When you read the Mishnah tells us, now these are ancient Jewish writings, eyewitness accounts of these of this ceremony. They said for the last 40 years that the temple stood, the lot for Azazel always came in the right hand and the lot for the Lord came in the left. Now the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. For the last 40 years, the temple stood, God's blessing was not on them. Well, what happened 40 years earlier, around 30 AD? What happened? The priest, the high priest, the Sanhedrin, the priest, the leaders of Israel, they condemned their Messiah. It's like God's blessing is now removed from the temple service. Now, it's so amazing when you talk to Orthodox Jewish people, they're all aware that for the last 40 years, things switched. God's blessing was reversed. It's all right there in their histories. But they don't realize why. They can't quite figure out why. We know why. Now, if you want to see the actual box with the lots in it, you can go to the Temple Institute, and there they are. There's the box. And they made the lots, this is the one that says Azazel right here. They made the lots a little covers so the high priest can't peek and cheat and see which one's which. So he reaches in and grabs them and he flips them open, then he sees which is which. But you can see the box and the lots. They're already made, ready for use. Okay, so going back just a second, Do you notice the men with the red strips of cloth in their hands? The goat for the Lord, they would take the red cloth and wrap it around the neck of this goat. The goat for Azazel, they'd take the red cloth and tie it around the horns of the goat. Then they'd take this goat for the Lord, this one here, and turn it around the other way, because he's going to be going to the altar, and then his blood's going to go on further into the Holy of Holies. This goat's going to be going the opposite direction, out to the wilderness. Okay? So, we'll come back to those in a moment. So he's drawn the lots over the goats. Now he goes back to the bull that he's confessed his sins over, the sins of his family. Oh, and I see your hand up over here. Yes, Jim.
In the high priest clothing,
yeah, the ephod. That's that apron-like thing with the straps. That's called the ephod.
Is that the object or the unit that there would be yes or no answers to?
No, that would be in the breastplate, the koshen. There's a pocket in the koshen where the Urim and Thummim would be kept. But it was attached to the ephod. The ephod's what held it in place. But they're two separate parts of the garments. Yeah, thanks for asking that. This could be very confusing. I'm sure other people had that same question. Yeah. Okay. He goes back to the bull, leans his hands on it a second time, and says, Aaron is to present the sin offering bull, which is for himself, and he's to make atonement on behalf of himself and his household. And then he makes a second confession. I beg of you, Adonai, I have acted wickedly, rebelled, and sinned before you, I and my family, and the children of Aaron. Now, this time it's not just for the high priest and his family, but for all the children of Aaron, your holy people. I beg of you, Adonai, forgive now the wicked acts, rebellions, and sins. And is a very similar confession to the first one. And then he goes to the side of the altar, and he slaughters the bull and catches the blood in this pitcher. It looks like a pitcher with a pointy bottom. Says he is to slaughter the sin offering bull, which is for himself. And there's a photograph of the actual golden pitcher that will be used when the temple is rebuilt. Now, this is a stand right here that the pitcher sits in, and they've got a little stand here for the handle. But the reason they make the pitcher with a pointy bottom is so you can't just set it down when it has blood in it. It'd fall over and spill. It has to be held. It can never be set down once the blood is in there. And so once he catches the blood, until he's done with it completely, someone would be there stirring it so it would not coagulate, one of his assistants. And so he's handed off the blood to this guy standing in the back. Now here he is. He's gone up the altar, up at the ramp to the altar. He has a golden shovel, and he is getting some coals from the altar. There you can see him, and he says he takes a censer full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord. So there's the shovel of coals, and now he's got a pan. He's putting a double fistful of incense into the pan. Then he takes both of these, and what he does, he goes now into the temple for the first time that day. He goes into the temple. And he's going to go up. And this is the parakeet going across here. This is the veil that goes across. Remember when Yeshua was crucified, what happened to that veil? Torn in half from top to bottom. I have to share another comment here. You know, there were two doors to the temple, or two barriers to the Holy of Holies. There were the huge bronze doors out here on the outside. Huge bronze doors right here. But then there was the veil here. Well, it says that when Yeshua was crucified, God tore the veil from top to bottom. But how about the doors here? Well, go back to the Mishnah. You know how the Mishnah said those last 40 years the temple stood, the lot for the Lord came up in the left hand, the lot for Azazel on the right? It also says during those last 40 years, these doors kept swinging open on Yom Kippur on their own. They just swung open. So God not only tore the veil, as we're told in Matthew, but the Mishnah tells us he kept opening the doors as well. In other words, there's no barriers between you and me now. Because the real high priest, of which this is all a shadow, he has come. He's entered the Holy of Holies, not made with hands, not by the blood of bull and goats, but by his own blood. He's made a way for us to come in. So the shadows still hold. The barriers are gone. It's an amazing thing to think about. Now, this veil, it was a double veil. Whether it went up over, I think it went up over like a pole. And so it'd come down and come down, so there'd be like the front half of the back, like a towel going over a towel rack, right? And what he would do, he would go into the left side, walk between the two halves of the veil, and then come out on the back side. And here you can see a picture of him doing that. He'd keep his elbows out. After all, he's got a shovel full of hot coals, does not want to catch the veil on fire. And so he would go in on the left, he would go with his elbows out and walk from left to right. And once he got to the other end, he could then step into the Holy of Holies. And so he brings them inside the veil. So his first trip is to take in the incense. He puts the shovel of coals on the stone there in front of the Ark of the Covenant, and then he puts the incense onto the coals, and the whole place, the whole Holy of Holies, was filled with a cloud of incense. Now, when you read in Hebrews, it seems odd. People are always asking questions. When it describes the Holy of Holies in Hebrews, it says that in the Holy of Holies, there was the Ark of the Covenant and the golden incense altar, the old golden incense censer. And they say, but that's supposed to be outside the veil. Well, you're right. But he's describing Yom Kippur, when the golden shovel of coals had the incense put on it inside the Holy of Holies. So when you read Hebrews, it can make sense to you because he's describing the day of Yom Kippur. It says he must then put the incense on the fire before Adonai, and the cloud of incense will cover the ark cover, which is above the ark of the testimony, so that he will not die. And then he prays. Now notice the chain. See the chain going back out under the curtain? The only place I can find this chain mentioned that would go around his ankles in the Zohar, so which means it may or not be fact. But the idea was is that if he did something wrong in here, he might wind up like Nadab and Abihu. They went into the Holy of Holies and they died. So in this case, if the high priest does something wrong and gets struck dead, they can just haul him out by his ankle and the chain tied around it. Now he goes out of the Holy of Holies. And remember that pitcher of blood from the bowl? He now takes that pitcher of blood. Then he is to take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the eastern face of the ark cover. And in front of the ark cover, he is to sprinkle some of the blood 7 times with his finger. So this is his second trip into the Holy of Holies. And he takes the blood of the bull and sprinkles it 7 times. Now, we always get the picture that he sprinkles it on the Ark of the Covenant itself. Maybe. But the Hebrew does not necessarily mean on, it can mean toward. And according to the accounts that were existed at the time this was taking place, it said it was never put on the ark cover. It was always sprinkled right in front of the ark cover, as you can see here, onto the ground. He goes back out of the Holy of Holies. Now remember the two goats, one for the Lord, one for Azazel? The one for the Lord that's pointing towards the temple, he now brings it to the altar and says he must then slaughter the sin offering goat, which is for the people. Now the bull was for him, his family, and all the children of Aaron. But the goat is for all the people, all the Israelites. He catches its blood in a different pitcher. This is a smaller one. He goes back into the Holy of Holies a third time. Says he is to bring its blood inside the veil. He's to do with its blood just as he did to the blood of the bull. He is to sprinkle it on the ark cover and in front of the ark cover. So now there's going to be a second row of little drips in front of the ark. He then goes back out of the Holy of Holies. Now how many times has he been in so far? 3 times. The incense, taking the blood of the bull, taking the blood of the goat. He has a 4th trip in he has to make. So he's to make atonement for the holy place and the impurities of the Israelites and even for their willful sins. Now catch that, willful sins. This should jump right off the page at you. Because if you're familiar with the sacrificial system in Leviticus, there is no sacrifice for willful sins. If you sin willfully and then decide you're sorry for it and go to the priest, what sacrifice should I bring? Or what kind of sin did you commit? I sinned willfully. Sorry, buddy, there's no sacrifice for that. You go to the Lord directly and cast yourself on your face and ask him to forgive you. You just ask for his grace and you repent. But there's no sacrifice to bring for that. The sacrifices were only for unintentional sins. But look what God says. On this day, he'll make a cleansing and atonement for the willful sins among all their sins. And so shall he do for the meeting tent, which resides with them in the midst of their impurities. Nobody is to be in the meeting tent when he enters to make atonement in the holy place until he goes out and he has made atonement on his behalf, on behalf of his household, on behalf of the whole assembly of Israel. So here he stands before the paraket, and down here you can see the drips of blood. Blood from the bull and blood from the goat. He then takes the blood that's left over from the goat and pours it in the pitcher of the blood from the bull. He puts the two together, mixes them together. Then he is to go out to the altar which is before the Lord and make atonement for it. He is to take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat. And this altar is the golden altar of incense. It's about 3 feet tall, about 1.5 feet square at the top. This is where incense was burned in front of the veil. And you can see here he's putting blood on each of the horns of that altar. And it says, and put it all around on the horns of the altar. Now, I'm going to stop for a second. Why didn't you do this one first? Why did the blood have to be taken into the Holy of Holies first, and then this altar second? It's a very important lesson here for us. Very important lesson. Think of Yeshua. Think of yourselves. Think of what this means to you. And you should be able to arrive at the answer. The bull and the goat, who do they both represent? Yeshua. They both represent him. In fact, the goat Azazel represents him as well. We'll get to that in a moment. All three of these sacrifices represent him, aspects of his death. What does the altar of incense always represent? Always, always, always. And the writer of Hebrews also brings this out. The altar of incense right in front of the veil, what does it represent? Prayer. There you go. And even though you couldn't go into the Holy of Holies, your prayers, the incense can go up and over into God's presence. This is anointed after the blood of the bull and goat are taken in to God's presence. What does that teach you? Our access to God through prayer is based upon something else first. That's Yeshua's sacrifice. When we come to God in the name of Yeshua, it's because he has made a way for us to go in. He has given his life. He has shed his blood. He's made a living way for us to go before the Lord. Because of that, we can now approach God in prayer whenever we want, no matter what we're doing, any time of day or night, by yourself, with others, we have constant access before God at all times. It's really an amazing picture. Now, people could pray before, of course, but just as they had to look forward to a day when God would make a new and living way for them, we in faith look back that he has done so. They had to look forward in faith. We have to look backward in faith, but it's still faith either way. And it still points to Yeshua, who's the center of the menorah, holds up everything. You everybody get that? Okay. Then he's to sprinkle on it some of the blood with his finger 7 times, and there you can see him doing so, and cleanse and consecrate it from the impurities of the Israelites. When he has finished purifying the holy place, the meeting tent, and the altar. And you see he's gone back outside now to the big altar, that would have been a bronze altar at the tabernacle, this big altar where the animals are placed. He would pour out the blood there at the corner of the altar. There's a special place for that blood to be poured. Now, this goat to Azazel, this scapegoat. He says he is to present the live goat. Aaron is to lay his two hands on the head of a live goat and confess over it all the, there we are again, willful sins of the Israelites and all their rebellious sins among all their sins and place them on the head of the goat. What's the difference between a willful sin and a rebellious sin? A willful sin can be when you're tempted, you know it's wrong, but the temptation is so strong you just give in to it. Rebellious sin is when you're angry at God. I'm just so mad, I'm just going to do this anyway. I don't care what he thinks. And these are all confessed to put on the head of this goat. And this is the third confession. I beg of you, Adonai, your nation, the family of Israel, has acted wickedly, rebelled, and sinned before you. I pray with your name, forgive now the acts, rebellions, and the sins for your family. The family of Israel has acted wickedly, rebelled, and sinned before you. And then I made a note here. Then the priests and the people who were standing in the courtyard when they heard the ineffable name coming from the high priest's mouth would kneel and prostrate themselves and fall upon their face, say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malkuto Le'olam Va'ed. Blessed be the name, the glory of his kingship forever and ever. And then you can see a man here. And he has a leash or a rope. And he's taking this goat to Azazel. And there was a bridge going off the east side of the Temple Mount across the Kidron Brook to the Mount of Olives. And some people would follow him, but others would stand on the side and jeer at the goat. They would jeer at it because it's got all their sins on it. It's like, get out of here. We don't want you. Go away. They would jeer at him, kind of like what they did with Yeshua when he was going to the cross, when he was carrying his cross to Golgotha. It says, and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man standing ready. Now this man would go out to the wilderness, about a 10-mile journey, way out. And there are steep cliffs there. You can see the Dead Sea just right over there. You can almost touch it. In fact, in Jerusalem, from the Mount of Olives, you can look out and see the Dead Sea. It's a pretty amazing thing. And he would take part of the red cloth and tie it to a rock. The other half is still tied around the goat's horns, and he would push the goat over the cliff. He did not want this thing wandering back into town with all their sins on it. So this goat to Azazel was killed. And it says, the goat is to bear on itself all their iniquities into an inaccessible land, so he is to send the goat away into the wilderness. And so off he would go. Now, what would happen? Remember the man who had he had tied the red cloth around the other goat? What happened to that red cloth? When they went to sacrifice that goat, they would take that red cloth off of it and tie it to the door handles of the temple. And when this goat died out in the wilderness, that red cloth tied to the handle of the temple would turn from red to white. It was a miracle. And it would happen every year. Except those last 40 years, the Mishnah tells us. Those last 40 years, from about 30 AD to 70 AD, the cloth stayed red. What do you think God's trying to tell them? You guys did something wrong there. 30 AD, something went haywire. My blessing has been removed from what you're doing. Now, while this is taking place, the high priest would go back and to the people who were gathered there in the outer court, he would read from the Torah. And guess what he would read? The chapter we're reading, Leviticus 16. And he would teach on it, talk about it. And you see how happy he is. He's survived three trips into the Holy of Holies. He's got one more to make. But he figures if he's made the first three without dying, he's probably pretty safe on the fourth. And he goes back and makes one more trip because he has to pick up the shovel of coals and the pan that had the incense in it. And this is his fourth and final trip. Aaron must then enter the meeting tent, take off the linen garments which he had put on when he entered the sanctuary, leave them there. So now he's taken off. These are the golden garments you can see. He's washing again. He's donning just the four linen garments. that he must bathe his body in water in a holy place, put on his clothes, and go out. And make his burnt offering, the people's burnt offering. See, up to this time, the body of the bull and the other goat were just laying there on the north side of the altar. So now he takes out the fats and the innards and the parts that the Torah provides and indicates for sin offerings. He removes those and he goes up onto the altar and throws those into fire. And make his burnt offering, the people's burnt offering, so he's to make atonement on behalf of himself and the people. Then he is to offer up the fat of the sin offering and smoke on the altar. And the one who sent the goat away to Azazel must wash his clothes, bathe his body in water, and afterward he may re-enter the camp. Now there's the body of the bull and the body of the goat. It says, the bull of the sin offering and the goat of the sin offering, whose blood was brought to make atonement in the holy place, must be brought outside the camp, and their hide, their flesh, and their dung must be burned up. They'd be taken out to the Mount of Olives, the same place where the red heifer body would be burned. And none's a menorah pattern. The red heifer, female cow, red cow. Here we have a bull and a goat. Their purposes are different, but they're both taken to the same place and their bodies are completely burned there on the Mount of Olives. So here we have two more balancing truths to talk about the accomplishments of Messiah for us. Then the high priest, the day is about over, it's almost sundown, the high priest completes his duties for the day by kindling the menorah. So there you can see him. He's put oil in the menorah and he's setting the wicks. And there's the golden menorah that is now completed, ready for the temple to be rebuilt and to be installed. It stands about 4 feet tall, I would say. And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And you can go to Jerusalem and see it right there. And it says, and the one who burns them must wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, and afterward he may re-enter the camp. This is to be a perpetual statute for you. In the 7th month, on the 10th day of the month, this would be next Tuesday evening in our case, you must humble yourselves and do no work of any kind, both the native citizen and the foreigner who resides in your midst. This is for Jew and Gentile. For on this day, atonement is to be made for you to cleanse you from all your sins. You must be clean before Adonai. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest for you, and you must humble yourselves. This is why we fast. It is a perpetual statute. The priest who is anointed and ordained to act as high priest in place of his father is to make atonement. He is to put on the linen garments, the holy garments, and he is to purify the Holy of Holies. He is to purify the meeting tent of the altar. And he is to make atonement for the priest and for all the people of the assembly. This is to be a perpetual statute for you to make atonement for the Israelites for all their sins once a year. So he did just as Adonai commanded Moses. Now, I want to go back to the two goats for a moment. The reason there are two identical goats is because these two goats represent one sacrifice. Two aspects of one sacrifice. Two aspects of what Messiah accomplished for us. On the one hand, though we call Yeshua a sacrifice, it's true because he sacrificed himself, but he was not a Levitical sacrifice. First of all, human beings are not kosher. You can only put a kosher animal on the altar, not human beings. Second of all, he wasn't killed by a priest. He's killed by Romans. Third, he was not killed painlessly. He was tortured to death. Fourth, he wasn't killed in the temple. He was killed out, probably like a garbage heap almost, out at Golgotha, the place of the skull. Fifth, none of his body parts are put on the altar. They were just put into a tomb. You see, everything about Yeshua's death, his sacrifice, is like that of the goat that bears away the sins in the wilderness. That goat wasn't killed in the temple. Body was not put on the altar. Wasn't killed by a priest. Just as a designated man. And tradition says it had to be a man who had less than a year to live. And he wasn't slaughtered with a knife. He was just pushed off a cliff. And people jeered at it. It was taken into the wilderness. Yet that is the only animal, and listen to me when I say this, that scapegoat is the only animal in the entire Bible, the only single one, that is ever said to bear away the sins of the people. Even their willful sins, their pesha is the word, their rebellious sins, all their sins. Not the animals put on the altar, but that one single animal that was not really a sacrifice, it bore them all away, took them all away. What's that a picture of? It's Messiah. You know, so many times I've heard people teach and say, you know, Pilate took Yeshua and he took Barabbas. And they say, see, there's the goat, the sin offering, and there's the scapegoat. And because Yeshua died on the cross, Barabbas is like the scapegoat, gets set free. No, he's not. Barabbas is you and me. That's who we are. We're the ones who go free. But Yeshua pictures both of these goats. And the one bears the sins off into the wilderness, but the other, his blood is also taken into the Holy of Holies. That's Yeshua. He did both of those things. It took two goats to picture what our one Messiah did. It's a powerful picture, a powerful image. Don't ever forget it. But that is the only animal in the entire Bible that is said to bear away the sins of the people. And that animal is a picture of our Yeshua. Now, I always finish with this quote from John 1:29, where John the Methodist is out, and he sees Yeshua and he says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." Well, here's the problem. If he'd said, "Behold the goat of God who takes away the sins of the world," then it would make sense. He doesn't say goat, he says lamb. Nowhere does a lamb bear away sins. You can't find it. It's not there anywhere in Leviticus, where the lamb is a sin offering that takes away sins. It doesn't do it. It's always the scapegoat. That's the only one. What's John doing? What animal do we talk about at Passover in the spring? The lamb. The blood of the lamb is put on the door on the outside for God to see. The body of the lamb is eaten by the people to give them strength to walk out of slavery in the morning. That's Passover. That lamb has nothing to do with sin. Has nothing to do with forgiveness of sin. It's all about our deliverance. But at Yom Kippur, we see a goat that takes away the sins of the world. What's John doing? He's taking Passover, he's taking Yom Kippur, and saying these two are a menorah. They make a menorah. One shows the outside, shows what we enjoy, the experience we have of deliverance and of life, of freedom. But the other is a picture of what it cost for us to have that. It's a picture of what our high priest accomplished all by himself with no help from anybody. And if he had failed in one detail, it'd all be a wash. It'd all be done. So John is taking the two images. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And he puts them together. And that's what we do every Yom Kippur during this time. Because I just think it's an act of appreciation for us to sit through this teaching and rehearse again how great a Savior we have, what an amazing high priest we have, how great a salvation has been won for us through our high priest Yeshua and his sacrifice. Absolutely perfect. Complete and perfect. Yes, questions. Deborah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'd represent us. Yeah, the question was, the man who went and took the goat and pushed him off the cliff, he kind of represents us. Yeah. Yeah. He did the deed. And probably the Romans and the Jews, you know, who were instrumental in actually killing Yeshua. So you see Jews and Gentiles teaming up to accomplish the same goal. They couldn't get along on anything, but here you see the Romans and the Jewish leaders. They're teaming up. We're going to kill this guy. That's one thing they agreed on. It's a picture of Jews and Gentiles today, the whole world. We're all guilty of Yeshua's death. Yeah. Tim in the back. Yes, with the microphone.
Yeah, because I bring my own question. Going back to the pictures and stuff, there was, I always forget, there is the outline of the ark.
Yes.
The right. Why is that? Is it just because it would be in the way, or is there some other reason why?
Great question, yes. If you remember, when it showed the high priest putting the blood on the ground, the ark was just in an outline form. That's because when Yeshua was on earth, there was no ark in the temple. The ark had been hidden away after Solomon's temple. And there are theories as to where it is hidden today. But there was no ark in the temple at the time Yeshua was on earth. Now, with that said, Yeshua still drove money changers out of the temple courtyard and says, my father's house is to be called a house of prayer for all nations. You've made a den of thieves. He still called the temple his father's house. He still honored the temple. But there was no ark inside that time. So since this depicts Yom Kippur during the time of Yeshua, that just the outline of where the ark would have been is shown in the diagram. Yeah. And speaking of diagrams, unfortunately, I cannot put this online. If you want to look at this later, you can't. Because of copyright issues, just the way it is. You can come to my house, look at my iPad if you want, but I can't put these online. I just don't want to violate any copyright agreements. Yes, Peter. Let's get a microphone up to Peter here.
And now, when the high priest cleans himself with water, does he do that outside the temple or within the temple?
Up on the wall of the temple is where he did it in the first century, up on the wall of the temple. And there was a mikveh up there, and people couldn't really see because he's way up high, and the wall kind of blocked your view. And then the men would stand around with the cloths and give him privacy. But that's where that took place at the time. Yeah. I saw another hand up here. Yeah, Brian. Oh, let's get a microphone to you first.
Did you not say in an earlier teaching that the word for lamb that John used there in John 1:29 was exactly the same Hebrew word that could be used for kid or young goat? Mm-hmm. So that in essence, John was employing both words. Behold, I think you said se.
Yeah, there are several different words for sheep, for a sheep or a lamb or kid. And because since these were shepherds, they had a lot of different words for sheep and so on. And exactly which word John was using, since that was in Greek, it's hard to say. So was he using the word se or the word, someone help me here, the other word for lamb? Can't remember it right. I can go from Hebrew to English. Well, I'm terrible going from English to Hebrew. But kevis, thank you, kevis. So whether he's using kevis or se, we don't quite know. But traditionally, Passover over the years is always attached to the lamb. Yeah, there in the Exodus, it could be a kid of the goats or a lamb of the sheep. They could use either one. But over the years, it was always a lamb that was used. Always a lamb. And so I forget just what word it is in Greek, but it still is translated as a lamb.
But in light of the fact that it was a kid that took away the sin. Mm-hmm.
It would be more appropriate, but it seems to be the word lamb that is used there in the Greek, from what I recall. So it's like John is just making people go, what? And he's combining Passover and Yom Kippur together. So, all right. Yes, Amy, let's get a microphone over to Amy.
Question about it seems to have a lot of details about the high priest and the temple staff, and I just wondered about the general population, like what they would be doing during that day. Maybe some, like you said, at the temple listening, but would the families all come, or would they be at home?
No, it was not a pilgrimage feast. Thank you. It was not a pilgrimage feast. There was no commandment to go to Jerusalem, I mean, for this. They would be coming to Jerusalem a few days later, because 5 days after Yom Kippur begins Sukkot, the week of tabernacles. They would have to come for that. That was a commandment. No commandment to be here for Yom Kippur. But a lot of people go anyway. Let's go early, and let's find a place in, because If you picture it, that's the temple doors right there. And you've got the altar right here and this area where the priests would operate. Then right over here, there were steps, like three steps going up to that platform. Then behind me was the Nicanor Gate. And there was a section maybe 6 foot deep that would go from side to side. And people could stand there. And the platform where the high priest was doing the sacrificing and drawing the lots would be about, maybe chest high, waist high, if you're a tall person. And so you could stand there. You're allowed to stand. And they said thousands of people would squeeze in there. They could not go up the steps in the area where the priest was. But they could stand there, and the platform was about chest high, and they could watch what was going on. And they were absolutely silent while they watched all this. Until he prayed one of the prayers, one of the confessions. Then we all say, blessed be the name of his kingdom, the glory of his kingdom forever and ever. Then they would make that response. But a silence after that. And the Mishnah said, no matter how many people might come, they always fit in there okay. They say that was a miracle as well. But there's no commandment, but people would come to spectate anyway. Yeah. All right. Carla.
Any idea about how long this whole process took?
All day. It started, remember there's a commandment about the Tamid offering. Every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you offered a lamb in the morning, and that's what started the day in the temple. And at the end, you would have a drink offering, you'd have to pour that out, then you'd have a lamb, there'd be a lamb that was sacrificed in the evening, and that brought the day to a close. The high priest did both of those sacrifices as well. I just didn't bother mentioning those here. But he would do the first lamb in the morning, all the things that pertain to it. He would do the last lamb in the evening, all the things pertain to it. Everything in between, it was just him.
Yeah. The guy who took the vote to Isaiah had changed his clothes too.
After he came back, before he could come back in. Yeah, it was an all-day affair. Yeah. And go back to Amy's question, the only thing people were required to do was a fast that day. They would fast. And of course, they'd be thinking about why we're fasting. They'd be thinking about what's going on in the temple, but they had to think about like we do. They couldn't go in and watch it, but they had to imagine it and what was going on, because this was a spiritual thing. So the spiritual we experience in our minds. Passovers, we eat the foods and eat the matzah and break, and look for the afikoman and drink the glasses of wine. And we're participants. But Yom Kippur, everybody then and everybody now, we experience it in our minds. We have to imagine. We read the scriptures and think about it. Physical, spiritual, left, right, Passover, Yom Kippur. That's how it all fits together. Yeah. Oh, we see all these hands. How about we take three more quick ones, and because I don't want to violate our time limits here. So we'll start with the Angela, then there were one or two over this way.
Actually, that's perfect timing. When you said the priest went in from the left,
yeah,
and then traveled over to the right to go into the Holy of
Holies, right.
That goes, am I correct, that's from the physical
into the spiritual. Very good. Yes, from left to right. And then you come out going from the right to the left, spiritual to the physical. Mm-hmm. Okay. And over here, Adam. And then who's our third questioner? So the guys in the microphones can have a heads up. Who's the third one?
Jim.
It was Jim? Oh, I see Tony back here too. All right, I'll have to take two more questions. All right, it's going to be Tony then. Okay, Adam, yes.
I like to try to picture sometimes the real down-to-earth parts, like who was the person, like maybe who were the person who collected the frankincense that would be used for the incense. Yeah. Like these little tidbits. And one thing, how old was the high priest? Because I know for other priests, you were in service, wasn't it, mid-20s to 50s, and then your role switched.
Yes.
Because it's hard work. And I'm picturing, mm-hmm. like, what's the age of the person I'm picturing walking around? And,
yeah.
Because that's hard work, slaughtering a bull.
It is. The Torah, I'm trying to remember the age the Torah gives for the maximum. Is it 50? 50. So after 50, they could no longer do this. It was hard work. I remember a priest, especially a high priest, had to be physically perfect. Physically perfect. He couldn't even have a crooked nose, or he could not even have a unibrow. You know? I mean, he had to be a physically perfect human specimen, or he couldn't serve as the high priest. And that speaks of the perfection of Messiah. Yeah. Okay, and then I think Tony is our last one.
As much as we're learning here, I keep seeing that this is what I feel the message is coming to me. Is no matter how hard we try, we fall short. And I keep seeing the mercy and the forgiveness of our Heavenly Father.
Yes.
As long as we recognize, as long as we, in our heart, we try.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I keep saying.
Good point. That's a perfect way to finish this lesson, Tony. And you know, when people start talking about how unnecessary the sacrificial system is and how it was this and that and everything else, it's like, you never studied Yom Kippur, because there's so much grace and mercy and forgiveness and deliverance, and it's an incredible day of grace. And I don't know of any study that quite summarizes what Yeshua accomplished for us like this does. I know every year when I do this, my appreciation for my Savior is always set back up where it should be. And what a Savior we've got. And with that, let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, we thank you so much for this wonderful time of year. And I pray, Lord, that we would do the hard work of investigating our own souls and doing the work that needs to be done there. Help us to face ourselves with open eyes, to see what needs to be done, and to make the corrections you give us to do. Father, you do all the work necessary that we can't do. But you won't do one thing of the work that you've given us to do. That's ours. So, Father, help us to do our work. Help us to make the changes in our lives we need to make. And, Lord, make us aware of the sins in our lives, the shortcomings that maybe you've been trying to get our attention for a long time. I pray during these days of awe, you will get our attention, and we will wake up and make the changes we need to make and become people of purity. Make us the people you want us to be. And with the help of your Spirit, we know you, we will. And we praise you for it all in Yeshua, our high priest name. Amen. Let's stand together then as Tim comes and leads us in the blessings.